This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us today. It's been a long time since the American public was gaga over space exploration, but a new wave of entrepreneurs has reinvigorated the push to imagine the possibilities of the cosmos. One such person, Tesla Motors founder Elon Musk, has been pushing for humans to colonize Mars. This prospect came closer to a reality earlier this week when his space exploration company SpaceX entered an agreement with NASA. It was awarded an $82 million contract with the U.S. Air Force with the goal of getting to Mars by 2018. We talked about the future of space exploration when we were joined by astronomer Chris Impey, author of the book Beyond, Our Future in Space. Let's listen. You know, I'm old enough to remember when Kennedy spoke about going into space, and we were, of course, in the throes of the Cold War, and he was rallying the country to go into space, in a sense, to beat the Soviets. What's behind, you think, this new urge or desire for space exploration?
Right. I mean, and what you're alluding to was a glorious time in the space program. Going to the moon was a fantastic achievement that we've not equaled, of course, for 45 years. But it was sort of aberrant history because it was based on the Cold War and this rivalry. So, and then I think we went through a doldrums. You know, we had the space shuttle, which is kind of an antique technology that retired 2 out of the 5, destroyed catastrophically, didn't look very good. So I think this renaissance now is driven by something different. I mean, it's driven by economics, still driven by exploration and people who really are curious to see what happens when we move off Earth.
Scott Kelly went up recently, and while there was some interest, there isn't the sort of enthusiasm perhaps of 50 years ago, and perhaps it is more ho-hum to go into space or to go to the space station, for instance.
Right. And people forget that it is special. It's less than 600 people, I think, that have been into Earth orbit. That's a pretty select club. I think 10 times more have stood on Mount Everest. But it's not far. I mean, if you drove to Boston, that's the same distance. Yeah. You're just driving
Which
to Boston.
I didn't realize.
You're just driving to Boston straight up. It's not really a big deal when you say it that way. So that's just hugging the Earth. I mean, it's incredible if you did it. I mean, zero gravity would be amazing. The view, the blackness of space, the thin limb of the Earth's atmosphere would all be amazing. But it's not really leaving your backyard in terms of space.
Well, it certainly is risky to go into space. I mean, space is a very inhospitable place. Mm-hmm. I mean, while we might travel the Earth looking for whatever, space is a place where we really can't exist on our own.
Right. It's an unnatural place, and I think that leads some people to reasonably question, you know, why do we even want to go there, explore there, travel there, have colonies there? So, again, it gets to the exploration aspect. Right. People, there's no reason to go to the North or South Poles or climb high mountains where the air is thin. So people are doing it for various reasons to test themselves, to see how we might live elsewhere. But you're right, it's very inhospitable. There's high-energy radiation, micrometeorites. I mean, there's all sorts of hazards in space that you don't experience on the Earth.
Well, which is interesting to think about tourism and space travel. Mm-hmm. 50 years ago, of course, that wasn't even, you know, wasn't even part of our thinking. Mm-hmm. Do you see that as one of the sort of drivers of this need, this desire to explore space?
It's going to be a big business entity. So we've just experienced, you know, less than a dozen space tourists paying tens of millions of dollars, mostly to the Russians, to go to Soyuz. And that's a very rarefied air of tourism. Richard Branson is charging $250,000 for a suborbital flight. That's not even the drive to Boston up. That's not very far at all. And then when it scales up, you know, you can get a real enterprise. I poll my students when I teach astronomy. I did it just a few weeks ago, 18, 19-year-olds, millennials. And you just ask them, how much would you spend on a once-in-a-lifetime 3-day trip into orbit, assuming it's not super dangerous?
Sure.
And I can project that into an economic model for that cohort. And it projects to $30 to $40 billion a year of revenue, which exceeds Hollywood revenue. So it's a serious industry in projection, and it's just on the cusp of happening.
Does it trouble you that business people are sort of leading the charge for space exploration, government taking maybe a back seat or a side seat?
I think the mixed model makes more sense. And so the analogy I like to use, it's maybe a little stretched, is with the internet. So I think this year or around now is 1995 for the internet, the year that word was coined. And that was the year companies that no one had heard of, like Amazon and eBay and Yahoo, were formed. And that was basically the year the internet moved out of the government research domain, and that's the only people who used email back in the 1980s and so on, into the commercial arena, and it sort of never looked back. Mm. So if we are going through an analogous transition in the space industry 10 years from now, it could be unrecognizable.
Let's talk about some of the things that I guess are in the works, on the books, mm-hmm. have been talked about for some time, including space elevators. What is that?
Right. So space elevator is a sort of science fiction visionary concept where you basically string a cable into space to the point where it's suspended in air by the centrifugal force on it because the Earth is spinning. So this cable has to go 100,000 kilometers straight up. And the
what is 100,000 kilometers? What is that in terms of miles?
That's 60,000 miles.
Okay, 60,000.
So it's really far, several Earth radii up. And in principle, if you take it to the geostationary point where a satellite would remain directly overhead, then it will suspend itself. But you need a material that can handle the incredible tension of that much weight and that much distance. And no known material, some carbon nanotube composites get close, but they don't manage it. And the point of having a space elevator is that you get over this brutal calculus of the cost of launching something. I mean, people realize that the Saturn V rocket was this incredible thing. It's bigger than the Statue of Liberty. But 95% of it was fuel that you just had to burn to get those three astronauts in that little capsule into Earth orbit. It's incredibly expensive and inefficient. Right. So if you can build a space elevator, then you just put crawlers on the cable and you just go up and down with solar power for free, basically. So it's just the cost of the cable.
Just I'm thinking about the crawlers. I mean, just that, you know, that we have this on Earth,
yeah,
yes?
Yeah, exactly. So the technologies are not radical. They're not bizarre. But it all depends on this material, this magical mm-hmm. material that is strong enough to do this, Kevlar or something like that. It's got to be light and strong. So for an Earth-based elevator, we can't do it. But for the moon, which has one-sixth of the gravity, our current materials could do it. Oh. So the thinking now, while we wait for an Earth-based space elevator, is that the moon now becomes a much more interesting destination in space, because if you built a base there, and it's not too far, we know we can get there, we've been there before, you can mine the lunar soil for both water and oxygen. With water and oxygen, you can survive, and with the oxygen, you can make rocket fuel, adding hydrogen. And then with a space elevator on the moon, you've got a staging point to anywhere in the solar system really cheap, so you generate a huge potential economic activity.
So how close to something like this are we, and where did this idea first originate?
This first originated from a Russian visionary called Tsiolkovsky 100 years ago.
Really?
I mean, he imagined extending the Eiffel. The Eiffel Tower was being built, and he just looked at the Eiffel Tower as it was being built and thought, let's just take that up further. And, of course, 100 years ago, no chance of doing it, and then it went into science fiction world, and Arthur C. Clarke wrote about it, and he famously was asked, when are we going to get a space elevator? And he said, 50 years after people stopped laughing. Well,
people
have stopped laughing now. And so, you know, we could do it, and I think the cost may only be a few billion, $4 or $5 billion in 10 years on the moon, but not on the Earth. The Earth, we need some new technologies.
And obviously what it's made out of is the most critical thing. What about, you know, meteorites, space junk? I mean, things hitting this space elevator.
Yeah, the space elevator has hazards. Actually, some of the more interesting technical papers allude to one of the biggest hazards is it's such a huge, long stretch cable that instabilities and oscillations become one of the biggest issues. You have to damp out these things. So, you know, there are all sorts of technical issues. Engineers love this stuff because there's so many problems to solve to build a space elevator. But there are other things happening sort of right under our nose that are transforming the economics of space. And one of them is the miniaturization, these little CubeSats that you've probably heard about. They were just it was a spec where in something the size of a Rubik's Cube, you have all the components you need for a miniature satellite. And so that's busted the economics of satellite building because student groups can do this. You can put bunches of them together to do sophisticated things. So I think last year 140 or so CubeSats were launched, which is more than all the previous years. And so people are miniaturizing space technologies, and that's opening it up to a lot of new players.
What are solar sails? I mean, it's sort of – I can imagine them just by what they're called.
So solar sail, another venerable idea where you just make some gossamer-thin substance like mylar and you stretch it out, maybe a square kilometer of this, and you just get sun's radiation to propel you. And solar sail has a big advantage and a big disadvantage. The big advantage is it's free energy. The disadvantage is it's a gentle, steady push. So you don't accelerate with a big impulse like a rocket. It just gives you a steady, slow acceleration. But if you're patient, it's not really good for humans traveling around, but for payloads, it's great. The other problem is you can't leave the solar system because once you're too far from the sun,
you don't.
But you could, if you could get up to a high enough speed with a solar sail, you could then coast and then use the sun, the next star you reached, to decelerate. So
I'm thinking about Scott Kelly, but also the idea of human beings going deeper into space, a formidable environment. I mean, we've talked about food and water, fuel, things like that. What's on the drawing board for humans going into deeper into space?
So, I mean, the moon we know we could do, and it's only a week to get there. So, you know, you have a escape clause. Mars is tough, and that's, of course, the challenge.
Right.
Mars One is a private enterprise out of the Netherlands that is claiming that it'll set up a colony in about 12 or 13 years. But most people think they just don't have the wherewithal to do that technically. And the financial model based on reality shows seems a little flaky to a lot of people. NASA's backed off to maybe 15 or 20 years before humans go and spend significant time there. I mean, most people think it will happen. The challenge, of course, is a long deep space journey, maybe 8 or 9 months, subject to a lot of radiation. You will have a lifetime's worth of radiation dose in that 8 months, basically.
There's no way to protect from that?
Because, no, for the same unfortunate logic of space travel, that you could bulk up a spacecraft with hardening, but it makes it heavy and makes it expensive to launch, so it's a trade-off.
Is that why we need robots? I mean, to sort of be our pals in space?
And that's why we need robots. But if you can get to Mars and just handle that at little radiation dose, there are some technologies NASA's demonstrated that take the lunar soil or the Martian soil and make slump block out of it just with electrical energy locally. And then so you can make a hardened environment that's quite safe on Mars or the moon. I mean, we could build a habitat there quite comfortably.
That was my 2015 interview with astronomer Chris Impey, author of the book Beyond, Our Future in Space. When we get back from the break, we'll hear from Israeli-American restaurateur and chef Michael Solomonoff. Stay with us.
Space is the place. Space is the place. Space is the place, yeah. Space is the place.
Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Philadelphia's booming restaurant scene has so many superstars, it's hard to name them all. But Michael Solomonoff, the Israeli-American chef and restaurateur, has made his mark on our fair city and beyond. He's known for his local restaurants, Zahav, Abe Fisher, Federal Donuts, and Dizengoff. But his brand was just boosted when his cookbook called Zahav, A World of Israeli Cooking, won the James Beard Cookbook of the Year. He joined us a couple of years ago to discuss his heritage and his cooking, but also his struggle with drug addiction, which he had made public in a New York Times profile. Let's take a listen. I mean, how does it feel to be so now sort of out in the open? It must have been tough to be... tell friends and family, but now,
yeah,
people that don't know you know this.
I know. I don't. You know, every hour it sort of changes. It's been a big week. You know, I felt good about it, and I feel sort of relieved. Right. So, and I think it's been good, and I think I've gotten a lot of obviously friends and family and peers have been supporting me throughout this, but especially now. And, you know, even the last few days, I think there are a lot of people have been reaching out saying, you know, I've been struggling with this. Thank you so much. And a good friend of mine, actually, who's a chef, relapsed a little while ago and told me that this was sort of the kickstart that he needed.
Wow.
So it's good, and it was worth it.
Why was the time right for you? I mean, obviously, you must have thought about this before being interviewed by Frank Bunai.
I think that we just always have so much going on all the time, and it's hard to plan things. We have restaurant openings, children, all, you know, all this stuff. And I think that I was followed by a great writer named John Marchese for a Philly Mag sort of bio last year. And, you know, we hung out for about 4 or 5 days, and I was pretty frank with him about everything, but I wasn't ready, I think, I basically didn't want my parents to, like,
really
read all that. I was, you know, I wasn't
embarrassed. They weren't ready, perhaps?
I don't think I was ready, and I don't think everybody was ready. Since then, I just sort of, you know, I just became ready, I guess. And yeah. And the more press and the more accolades and all this positive stuff that we get, I think you know, there's this sort of like juxtaposition thing that's happening. It became more important for me to be honest about it.
Was that what ready meant? That it was time to be honest?
Yeah, I think so. And the details, I mean, obviously make probably for a great story too. So, I mean, other people are interested. You know, maybe it would be less romantic or exciting if, I don't know what, if I got a DUI or something, but just as dangerous and just as severe.
So what's it like to be sober?
It's great. It's great. I mean, you know, it's the best. It's the best thing. There are a lot of cliches that you sort of have to hold on to for hard times. But what was it? I heard this once. Somebody said, you know, I don't regret any of the decisions. And I believe this. I don't regret any of the decisions I made. This has given me the opportunity to recover, which has been the greatest gift. So it's true. I mean, my life is great. It's not without, you know, hard times like anything else, but it's fantastic.
So when do you think, or how old were you when you probably started to have problems with drugs and alcohol?
It's hard to say. I mean, looking back, I had all these like addictive tendencies that even as a kid, like a small kid. I would like compulsively eat candy, or you know, I like felt sort of comfortable cheating on tests, or you know, just things that seem insignificant at the time are like sort of a peer pressure thing, but things that I felt the most comfortable doing. You
taking
know?
Risks?
Yeah, absolutely. Taking risks, doing things that are maybe a little bit shady or dangerous or whatever. So, you know, that was, you know, I was sort of characterized by that, I think, at a young age. And then I think that just, you know, like experimenting with drugs and alcohol, which you think is sort of normal. I just happened to be very good at it, I think, and I felt the most comfortable sort of doing it.
Oh, I mean, so you felt more comfortable as yourself if you were high, for instance?
I think so. I mean, I think there's this sort of, you know, I for a long time wasn't very comfortable in my own skin. And it wasn't, you know, I grew up with loving parents. We had a great house. I went to a great school. You know, everything was in place for me to do just fine, you know, but it's, you know, if you don't have depression, or if you're have like low self-esteem or whatever it is, it's just, it's much easier to not be around, to not, you know, emotionally be present.
Do you think you had depression? Or
I think so. I think so. I don't think any more than probably anybody else. The way that I deal with it, though, is obviously different.
Right.
So.
I read, I guess, you went to college for a couple of semesters.
I did.
Smoked a lot of pot, or did a lot of, and also well, sold it, too, right?
I mean, I did. I'm not proud of it, but it's kind of the way it went. And I think that at the time, it didn't seem that crazy. I mean, you know, the thing is, I know plenty of friends, people that have done very well in college or very well in high school, or, you know, have dealt with trauma in their life, and they don't, you know, they don't react the way that I do. But at the time, it just seemed okay, you know, and I guess you hear this a lot too, functioning addict or alcoholic. And I'm like, well, it's only functioning until it's not, until something, you know, until the door, you know, the trapdoor drops and or opens or whatever. So I think that for a while it just seemed like I was, you know, pretty extreme in my partying or whatever. It didn't seem like that abnormal.
You mentioned the word trauma, and your brother was killed. This was back in 2003.
Yeah.
He was in the Israeli military at the time, killed by a sniper.
Yeah, he was. It was on Yom Kippur, 2003, so it was October 6th, and he was patrolling like the northern border, on the border of Lebanon, and was killed by Hezbollah snipers over the border. So, yeah, I mean, it sucked. It was really, really hard. And
was that the spiral down for you?
That was it. I mean, I think, like I said, I've always sort of had this addictive tendency, and I guess I've always been, you know, a drug addict or an alcoholic, or at least had that sort of mindset, and I think this was just, you know, a trigger.
Meaning that the drugs or the alcohol were just a way of sort of masking, obviously, the sadness, the loss,
yeah,
all the feelings that you were having at the time?
I guess I thought I was coping with grief. But, you know, a lot of people, like I said, choose other ways to cope. And I think that it was just easy for me. I mean, I just was more comfortable sort of not being present.
Right. And not feeling, perhaps.
Right. Right. Not feeling, not being present. And, you know, I could justify my actions because of this. So it became, you know, it's you manipulate a lot of people in active addiction, right? And dead or alive, you manipulate a lot of people. And I think that was sort of the case. I think at some point, you know, it wasn't me grieving. It was me justifying my use.
Justifying it. I mean, in a sense, using your grief as an excuse to,
yep,
to do drugs.
To get high, yep.
Wow.
I know.
I mean, you used crack cocaine, you used heroin, and you also at the same time were working, opening restaurants, you know, thinking in business terms.
Right.
How were you able to do that?
You know, I was surrounded by people that were incredibly hardworking, caring, creative, you know, loving. I mean, all these things. I did a lot in addiction. My business partner opened businesses, met my wife, got married, all those things. And I don't really know how.
Yeah. They didn't know.
I mean, I think probably looking back, there were points, and certainly towards the end. But, you know, you are, it's like an insidious disease, and you become very good at lying and manipulating. That was like one of the hardest things to do after I became committed to recovery. It was just not lying. Not spewing out lies all the time. It was how I sort of lived.
Your wife and your partner really had an intervention. I mean, they saw what was going on with you. Was there a precipitating event?
I think that it just the lying eventually didn't work. And, you know, we were under a lot of pressure when we opened the restaurant, and I needed to sort of be a leader and be all these things that I really wasn't being. And being a husband that was there physically and emotionally, just, you know, I wasn't that either. And it was just, eventually it just became obvious, you know, and there was no lying that I could have done to sort of make up for it.
So what happened at this intervention?
I mean, it was very, I guess what you'd see on like a Lifetime original series, you know, I kind of knew it was happening when it happened. I woke up and my wife pushed me down the steps and said, "You need to come downstairs." And, Steve and
your partner,
yeah, my business partner and Aaron O'Shea, who's another one of our partners, and my wife were sitting in the living room of my house, you know, and I was wearing a bathrobe, and I think Steve said something like, "We know that you have a problem. We want to take you to detox." And, you know, I made like a beeline for the backyard.
Did you want to escape?
Well, I did, but it was like, you know, of years and years of really keeping this in, it was the first time I had this sort of opportunity to just tell the truth. And I took it. And it was
that hard? I mean, to face your wife, your close friends, partners?
Yeah, I mean, it sucked. You know, I'd been lying to these people for so long. My wife, you know, we were married. I mean, for years, you know. And I'd been using my dead brother as an excuse to not be around. And I'd been, you know, for grief and used my position as a chef to, you know, kind of do whatever I want, you know, do whatever I wanted at work. And, you know, Steve and I had, you know, everything sort of invested in these restaurants. So it was hard. At the same time, I like went to rehab and detox and slept the best I'd ever slept that night after coming clean. So,
but it's interesting that after this intervention, you said that was the best night's sleep you had had for years.
Yes, yeah, it was fantastic
because you could finally be yourself.
Well, I felt like it was like the first time, and you know, I was 29 years old, so it was the first time in my life I'd really been honest about anything, and that was, you know, a tremendous weight lifted off my shoulders, you know. And that, of course, went away the moment I had to like be clean and sober,
yeah,
forever,
because that's the hard part, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I know you're not in the business of giving advice, but I wonder, as you think about the kind of support and family that you have had over this difficult time, what was the most helpful to you? I mean, obviously people intervening and being there for you, but it sounds like someone had to read you the Riot Act as well.
You know, there were a couple points where it occurred to me that the only way to get through this was to be super honest, which meant that if I had a thought at work, which happened every second of every day for like the first 6 months, I had to just open up about it, right, which is hard. I mean, it's really, really difficult.
The thought meaning,
you know, like, I want to go use. No, I want to go use. You know, it's like, you know, everyone talks about sort of triggers in the beginning. And the truth is that everything is a trigger. Right. I'm like, it's sunny out. I want to go use. It's, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning. I want to go use. We've had a bad day or things are going well. It's all the same, right? So, you know, for the first year, I mean, I would, you know, to this day, I'm pretty open too. But, I mean, you know, Steve and I would figure out how to, like, run this business or bring it back from almost failing. And I would, you know, talk his ear off, man. Right. Poor guy.
And he listened?
Yeah.
I mean, was that the most?
Probably the most helpful. I mean, obviously my wife, you know, being so diligent. And she would, for a long time, she would give me surprise, like, drug tests.
Oh. So she didn't quite trust you.
She should not have trusted me. Absolutely not. She should not have trusted me at all. And she had every right to do that. And to this day, we have like a drug test that she never sort of gave me. And I'm like, don't ever throw that out.
Oh. But I mean, in part, you grew up in Israel, part in the United States.
I was born in Israel, but I grew up in Pittsburgh. And then when I was 15, my family moved back. So I spent a year there. And then back to the States for a few years, back to Israel, and then here I am.
So feed in both,
yeah, exactly,
in both cultures.
Exactly. Well, what's interesting about the food that we cook, and this took a long time this took like a few years to really get comfortable and figure out our identity. But we take a look at the Israeli food and Israeli culture, which are many, many different cultures sort of put in one place. And I guess we're sort of like a third, you know, our narrative is a little bit different. Because we can sort of stick all those things together and, you know, have this Israeli cuisine.
Well, and as I said, the clip that I saw talked about something like 70 different cultures, you know, all influencing this small country and the food there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's from a cooking perspective and from a dining perspective, it's really stimulating. And, you know, it's also in the sort of like great agricultural sort of, you know, Mecca, there's like all this, just the farming there is amazing and everything, you know, nothing really sits on the back of a truck. Nothing travels for a week to get there. It's all...
Because it's all so small, right? The size of New Jersey, I'm told.
Yeah, it's like a little island. Yeah.
And did you grow up with a family of cooks, of food lovers, food enthusiasts, foodies?
Luckily, I mean, not foodies. Like, we weren't foodies, but like everybody in my family loves food. And my mom's a really good cook and my dad's a good cook. And my father's mother was like probably the reason I cook. You know?
So your grandmother?
My grandmother. And she was from Bulgaria and immigrated to Israel in 1948, but she was Sephardic. So, you know, her food is just, it was just amazing. Really, really good. But my mom is like a great cook and, you know, I'm lucky actually. My mother-in-law is a great cook too. So it's, I'm surrounded by good food. I was the pickiest eater for
a while. Oh, I was just going to ask you about what kind of eater you were.
Oh my God. I used to like take cheese off of pizza, wipe the sauce off, put the cheese back on. It was the worst.
Oh.
The worst. I know. I know. It gives hope for my children, you know?
So when did you start cooking, I guess, seriously, or get interested in food seriously?
Well, actually, when I dropped out of college, I moved back to Israel and got a job in a bakery, and I really like loved it. And then, you know, got a job at like a cafe. I was like a short order cook and knew that I wanted to cook after that.
Because?
I just loved the, I love sort of creating things. I mean, I think I was okay in school, you know, but I really was like so restless, and it was to be really busy and to be under a lot of pressure and to do sort of like, you know, hard work and to create things that were delicious and that, you know, the gratification is very quick.
Mm-hmm.
You make something good,
it's
hopefully.
It's either good or not.
It's either good or not, or people like it. And this, you know, years later, we realize there's this, like, emotional connection to everything. And that is just so satisfying.
Is there a favorite time for you at a restaurant?
Favorite time?
I mean, I don't know. hoping being the first person there or having it to yourself or when the evening is over hubbub?
I know. I don't really eat out at a lot of restaurants, but I don't know. I'm not sure. Probably not late anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. For the reasons that we've been talking about.
Well, I guess so, but I'm just like, you know, like I said, like I want to be at home drinking tea on my couch at like a certain
in your underwear watching TV,
yeah, exactly,
right?
Exactly.
You opened this restaurant. It's called Diesengoff.
Right.
And it's hummus.
Yeah, it's
what does Diesengoff mean?
Diesengoff is the first mayor of Tel Aviv, I believe, and there's a famous street in Israel, like a circle, like a promenade called Diesengoff Square. And it was like really sort of popular in the 80s, much like South Street, I think, here.
Uh-huh.
And when I was in boarding school, we used to sleep on like the park benches in the circle too. But so we were sort of into the name, and we've got this sort of like 80s rock kind of motif of all these like old Israeli rock posters on the wall. And we wanted to do a hummusia. It's like a very sort of traditional thing in Israel. It's just hummus. Like they make hummus. When they run out of chickpeas, they close, you know. So we make hummus and pita, like fresh pita in an oven there. And we get a couple little salads and pickles.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Do you still enjoy cooking? I mean, when you have several restaurants and you're running a business, is there still pleasure in cooking? Do you get a chance to do that?
You know, I wish I could cook more. I mean, I've sort of – so I'm like the chef or whatever. But I mean, the truth is, you know, my business partner Steve and I make decisions, including food, everything kind of together. So – and Aaron O'Shea is like the chef and partner at Percy Street.
Right.
And I, through all this, realized that I just love being the chef of Zahav. Not – as the owner, but I really love working in that restaurant. I just like have a great time.
That was my interview with Philadelphia restaurateur and chef Michael Solomonoff, whose cookbook, Zahav, A World of Israeli Cooking, was just awarded the James Beard Cookbook of the Year. When we get back from the break, we'll listen to my interview with tap dancer and choreographer Michelle Dorrance. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Michelle Dorrance, the MacArthur-winning tap dancer and choreographer, is currently running a groundbreaking new show at New York's Joyce Theater. Called ETM Double Down, it has dancers creating percussive accompaniment to a trio of musicians by tapping on electronic tap boards. She joined us in the studio last year following her MacArthur Award. We discussed her distinct approach to tap and even had her show us some of her moves. Let's take a listen. Your mom was a ballerina. Your dad was a soccer coach, or
right.
I guess still is a soccer coach.
Indeed.
For women's soccer.
That's right.
So was it inevitable you would be doing something with your feet?
That's what we all say. I did. I actually studied both ballet and played soccer growing up from a very early age. So that one thing I've done is use my feet quite a bit.
You apparently have flat feet, and that doesn't work so well for ballet. Is that true?
Yeah, that's right. That is, yeah. I knew, actually, both my parents they're both so incredibly adept at what they do. I knew at a very young age that I didn't have the natural flexibility or the feet, literally, for ballet. And I knew also at a very young age that I wasn't an international caliber soccer player.
Uh-huh. Yeah, 'cause my father, good, but not that good?
Yeah, he used to coach the national team. I'd always ask him if there was anyone on the team who was as slow as I was. I'm quick, but I'm not like 100-yard dash fast. So, and he said, yeah, there's one woman. I'm like, who? Shannon Higgins, who's like this exceptional center midfielder at the time in the 80s. And I go, oh, okay, so I could be Shannon Higgins, but maybe that's it. And also, I had like a 1 in a million chance of succeeding in that department. But yeah, I did pursue everything, you know, that was laid before me, but tap dance was my love so early on.
And how early on? A couple of years old?
Yeah.
Toddler?
Honestly, no, I think I started when I was 4, and I knew, I don't really remember a period of time where it wasn't my favorite thing to do. As a kid or a teenager or an adult, it's always been my passion since I can remember.
Which means you probably tapped all the time? I mean, were you always sort of doing things with your feet?
Yeah, no, I think either that or I love playing music and making music. My mom always tells me this story of, like, I memorized an album of Christmas songs when I was 2 years old. Like, I always loved, you know, that kind of thing, or that, whether it was a challenge or just, like, an absolute love. So, yeah, and I think the musical element in tap is what really drew me to it. Of course, I love dance and I love movement, but that, I think that synthesis is what makes it so, like, raw and so inspiring.
And we're talking, and in many ways, tap is movement and music.
Yeah,
I mean,
at the
tap
same time.
Is music, it's
exactly.
Percussion.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe an unfair question to ask you, but what would you say your style, what is it that you bring to tap dance that you think is uniquely your own?
Oh, that's always really hard to answer.
I know. I'm sorry.
Well, no, I mean, I think what I can say is that some of the people I just mentioned, among countless more, honestly, had such an impact on me that I feel like I'm from a generation that got to learn from so many different masters and stylists that, you know, and I think really Savion Glover is the big example of the, you know, young prodigy who all of this information and art and history was poured into and really was a revolutionary, both rhythmically and technically. So that I am also a student of his and a student of these, you know, incredible masters, like basically our ancestors while they were still alive, lends us to explore a lot of different directions at once, or allows those things to sort of form and, you know, for us to embody both the history and these innovations and explorations that were happening on a micro level. So I think that moving into the form now, there's so many possibilities. We want to do everything at once, like all the time.
Well, when I think of, even when you go back to the, you know, to the olden days of the 20th century, you think of solo dancers or perhaps dancing in duo.
Right.
What I hear, and actually I want to play just a clip from A Shared Evening. This is an excerpt of something you did, a Dance Space Project 2011. So it goes back a couple of years, but this is a group of people dancing together, dancing your choreography.
Yeah.
Let's give that a listen, and then we'll talk some more. An excerpt from A Shared Evening, Dance Space Project 2011. What's great is tap works on the radio really well.
I love it.
I mean,
but it's one of the great things about the form. And I think what the reason most of us, or a large number of us, are drawn to it is that you're making music through your dance. So I love listening to it. I mean, when you're watching dance, there's so much that you experience visually that you're not necessarily focused on the sophistication or nuance or tone or syncopation or some of, you know, those elements inside of the sound. But it's funny listening to that. I haven't given it that much attention every time I've watched that clip. I'm watching it as well. But isolating just the aural experience allows me to adjust. I'm like, oh.
We've got a small stage set up thanks to Stage Step. I'm going to toss it over to you, Michelle.
All right. Well, one thing I'd like to sort of talk about inside of this little moment
is
kind of creating a groove in different time signatures. So one that I just heard inside of that I love, we're performing that this week. So if I'm counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 9, 10, 1. It's just kind of hard to count and do it at the same time. But so this can be a repeated. And I can, yeah, a little mess up at the end. But so, like, we can create a groove and then have a break come out of it. So this is one of the things that we do often when we're working in any kind of repetitive rhythmic pattern, that kind of thing. And then at the very end, you heard something that we do quite a bit, which is a roll. So we have some of the same language as drummers when we talk about our, yeah, so this idea two different tones, a toe and a heel, literally toe, heel, toe, heel, toe, heel. That's our double stroke roll. So if I want to roll this a little faster. Continue all the way to. And a man who really developed a lot of rudiments that are similar to drum rudiments is a man named Steve Kondos, who is from Philadelphia.
You go. That's terrific.
Well known as a part of the Kondos brothers. So I mentioned Steve in part because there's a legacy in a lot of different major metropolitan areas of that. But he was the guy who literally developed a lot of tap rudiments as drum rudiments. So another roll I'll demonstrate for you, our four-count roll that we call paddle and roll. So what you heard there was. But you can use different parts of the paddle and roll as your downbeat.
Oh, wow.
Or. And each one, because of the tone, sounds a little bit different.
How important are heels?
Oh, if we're going to. This is a good lead into this next segment. I love using my heel. Like, I maybe overuse it because it's the bass. It's the lowest sound, except for like a toe knock. But this is. If I'm going to use a heel in the paddle and roll I just showed you, I can use it lightly. Or. Like that idea. It's an incredible counterpoint. And that using that low range against a much higher mid or treble sound, I love that. I love that counterpoint. I love the tonal range inside of it.
And do you think of yourself as a storyteller? I mean, you're a tap dancer, you're a choreographer. Mm. Are you also a storyteller?
Yeah, I mean, I think the form itself is such a storyteller. That we, you know, we really, in executing the form, we stand on the backs of those who, you know, sacrificed and innovated and pushed through racial barriers and pushed through economic barriers. And also, you know, the form fights the art versus entertainment, you know, problem. And there, you know, so many folks who sacrificed and pushed and were never credited are also then mocked or you know, there's I don't know, I feel like there's a long overdue respect that needs to be given to the form.
But I'm intrigued. This I guess struggle that tap dancers have.
Yeah.
Is it entertainment? I mean, we do associate
right.
it with things. I know you've done some dancing in Las Vegas, for instance.
Oh, yeah.
And you were part of Stomp.
Yeah, exactly.
And I mean, not that that is an art, but it's sort of finding that.
Yeah, and right finding mix. The art inside of the work, I think, regardless of what you're doing or what you're employed to do. But I think in exploring the form, storytelling, that's what you were talking
that's
about.
Right.
I think we are constantly telling a story in that so much of our vocabulary and style is rooted in very specific dancers through the history of tap that literally changed the technique of the form. And that is amazing. So there's a storytelling going on inside of what you choose if you're improvising or choreographing, what you're choosing, what vocabulary you choose to use. And then one of the things I'm most inspired to do with my dancers is explore their individual characters, their natural characters. Or, you know, I used to work with a dancer who was 6'8". I mean, like, my gosh, like, I just wanted to play with his body. I couldn't believe he could execute the things he could with how lanky he was. And he was an incredible technician. So, but there's that. I mean, you put a 6'8" guy with a bunch of, you know, no one's over 5'7", the juxtaposition in and of itself creates a story or creates a character. So there's, I'm constantly wanting to explore that. And then also exploring storytelling through the way different dancers execute different movement. That's always really fun for me.
And I'm curious, too, when you're waking up in the morning and first beginning to tap, are there things you do? Are there certain exercises you do to get your feet limber?
Yeah, now that I'm getting a little older, everything cracks. So, I mean, I could probably, I could give you a couple cracks just
there
like
we go. I think
here.
We heard some
but,
cracks,
Lately, I'm stretching my calves more than anything now, in part because I've also just recently started boxing again, so I'm jumping rope. But, very rhythmic, and here we are in Philadelphia. So there's a few things that I'm doing first thing in the morning, literally just rolling through my feet. Like you said before, they're flat, and they crack and need a little love in the morning. So I should definitely warm up more than I do, but I'm mostly focusing on my lower body, and then also, like, getting a good core and lower back warm-up allows you to use your legs and body any way you want to.
And do you have a favorite move or maybe a favorite thing that you want to demo with us?
Favorite move? Let me think.
And then we'll put you back in your other seat. And I know there's some folks that want to.
You know, I'll tell you this. We were talking about rolls earlier. So I'll do a 7-count roll, which is something that I'm, you know, been obsessed with for years. So if this is our 4-count roll, like I said before, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. So there's our 4. Our 7, 1. And it also rolls over the phrase. So I say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2. 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1. Yeah. So I also love the way the different tones roll over the phrase.
And is that why you've been obsessed with that rhythm? I mean, it is.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, I love it. Yeah. And you can play with different things. I could use my heel. Or. Yeah. You can. There's so much inside of it that you can play with. Yeah.
Michelle and I were talking during the break. She's going to do a little improv for us.
All right.
God, that was terrific. Thank you so much. I wish we had a gigantic auditorium here that could give you applause. And it was, I mean, from the subtlety to the really sort of in-your-face kind of performance.
Yeah, I mean, I think in a moment like this, I'm like, what am I going to do? So you just sort of follow what you're interested in rhythmically.
And you're catching your breath
yeah,
here.
Sorry.
I mean, this is, no, this is, it's a lot of work,
it
right?
It is, but it, I don't know. It inspires and motivates itself. I think that you're moving to create music is, I don't know, it's incredibly visceral and it's the best thing. I don't know why not everybody does.
That was my 2015 interview with tap dancer and choreographer Michelle Dorrance. Her show ETM Double Down is in the middle of its debut run at New York's Joyce Theater. And that wraps up this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, Liz Fiedler, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. I'm Marty Moscowing. Thanks for joining us today. Have a great weekend.